Welcome to the Midday for a Tuesday.
It's Norman and Vicki, and we're privileged to have one of the great faculty members and performers from across the street at the School of Music here at the University of Wisconsin, Christopher Taylor.
Welcome.
Thank you very much.
Let's see, before we get into some of the music that we have right at hand, you have a couple of interesting, slightly unusual concerts coming up. One is features a salute to a pianist, composer, who was prominent here some years ago and is still remembered, Gunnar Johansson.
That's right, yes. The centennial of his birth is coming up, and so there's going to be 3 days of concerts featuring his music and music that he performed and was interested in. And so I'll be involved on the first night, which is next Friday. And we're going to have a variety of things. My part of it will be the sonata that Johansson wrote in 1941 called the Pearl Harbor Sonata.
Heard of that?
Yeah, legend has it. I mean, he writes on the title page that he finished the piece on December 6th, 1941. And then I suppose he gave it its title the next day. It's even though I guess it was completed before the war had started for this country, it still is a very foreboding sort of work. And of course, war was in the air and had overtaken his native Europe.
About 20 years ago, or maybe a bit more, I interviewed Victor Borge. And after the interview, I got a phone call from Borge saying, by the way, I wanted to really say how important to me Gunnar Johansson was, you know, as a fellow pianist, as an influence and a person to share music with.
Yeah, he was certainly an incredible pianist, and I think a good composer, too. I'm enjoying this work very much. I mean, of course, I hadn't played it before, but it's falling under my fingers nicely, and it's, of course, very pianistic and rewarding for the player. It's how to describe his musical language. It's not sort of hardcore atonal, but it's not exactly neo-romantic either. It's it has I suppose some suggestions of perhaps Prokofiev or something like that. But as I said, it's a very dramatic work. It's in three movements, and the second movement is very very tender and quite beautiful. It has a sort of almost sort of Lutheran sounding chorale in the middle of it. The last movement features the rhythm that's we probably know best from Beethoven's Fifth Symphony, and that I guess is the Morse code for the letter V, as in victory.
That's the one.
And so he uses that rhythm quite a bit, and he creates a sort of demented kind of ragtime effect at the beginning of the movement, and then it heats up bit by bit. He doesn't actually tell you to speed up, but it seems to be written into the music in a way. He actually doesn't give any tempo indication at all. But then at the end, there's sort of a big Dies Irae. And it's,
wow, what a combination.
Yeah, ragtime and Dies Irae.
I wonder if this is a work that he recorded himself.
I know that there certainly exist cassette tapes with him playing. I mean, there are thousands of cassette tapes with him playing on them.
We have a bushel or so of them somewhere around here.
Yeah. Whether they're available, at at Amazon.com today, I don't know.
I doubt it.
Speaking of ragtime and its various exciting forms, you have brought with you some in the form of this William Bolcom piece.
Yes, this is it's from a recording I made several years ago now, probably 8 or 9 years ago, so I may have to renounce everything that I hear today. But It's a set of 12 etudes by Balcom that he wrote in the late 80s. And it's of course, a fabulous set. It's what won Balcom the Pulitzer Prize. And so, as I said, there are 12 of them. And the one I thought we could listen to is the eighth one, which is the Rag Infernal, the Infernal Rag. Balcom, of course, has always been very interested in ragtime and has written, I suppose, 20 or 30 rags of various descriptions, some of them more sort of classic Scott Joplin, some of them are pretty wild. So this one is on the wilder side, and it's certainly one of the hardest things you'll encounter, this piece. I mean, the left hand is jumping back and forth, the sort of stride bass pattern, but much more irregular and much faster than you'll encounter in your typical Joplin experience. So,
hang on.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, that's actually charming. You know? Yeah. A little bit of everything in there.
Exactly.
The subtitle is something like Apocalyptic Syncopation.
Right, yes, exactly. Balcom is, of course, a very fresh and creative sort of composer who takes popular genres and turns them into something pretty unexpected. And I think this provides a good example of that.
You have a wide appetite, a broad appetite for music, I know, from rags and from Mozart to Messiaen, and a lot of new music in your repertoire.
Yeah. I think what often happens for pianists is if they play any 20th century music, then they kind of get labeled a specialist, because they're plenty of pianists who don't play anything that was written after about 1900. But I think, you know, we have to keep the frontiers of the art form moving forward, and I think it is possible to get a little stagnant just playing the same old masterpieces over and over again from, you know, 150 years ago. I mean, no matter how great a piece is, I mean, whether it's the Tchaikovsky Piano Concerto or, you know, even you know, one of the sacred ones, Beethoven Opus 111 or whatever, overplaying them can cause fatigue and can make the listener jaded. So, on the other hand, I think it's stultifying and sort of it twists a pianist's perspective if they don't play anything but 20th century music. I mean, you have to play the earlier music as well. I mean, in order to play Messiaen convincingly, you have to be able to play Mozart. You have to be able to make a phrase. You have to understand sort of the principles of how musical lines and musical structures work. I mean, even though the language has changed a lot, many of those same principles still exist, and if you don't understand them, then you're not going to persuade the listeners that this outlandish avant-garde music is worth listening to. It'll just sound like banging to them, and, you know, it will be banging. And the thing is, people perhaps more often get away with the banging in the 20th century music than...
But you have to know where you're banging from. Is that really what you're saying?
Well, you have to bang right. And, in general, I'm not an advocate of banging. I mean, I play plenty of loud and crazy music, but you have to, you know, even in the most fortissimo passage, you still have to have a sense of shape, and they can't all be equally loud. And the sound still has to be wholesome and worth listening to.
Speaking of wholesome and worth listening to, and something that's 150 years old and has plenty of shape, how about something like that for contrast?
Good, yeah, this is a more recent recording of mine, the 12 Liszt Transcendental Etudes. And this one may rank as my favorite, although I think they're a fabulous set. I think it's Liszt and his profoundest and deepest, not any sort of the cheesy, virtuosic or Mephistophelian effects, you know, the endless diminished seventh chords and so forth. There's none of that in the Transcendental Etudes. I mean, of course, they're hard and they're showy, and yet it always seems to be to good effect and for a good reason. The history of these pieces, I should maybe just throw in a word about that, just because it's so interesting. And he wrote a first version of them when he was 16 years old, and they're these modest little sort of Czerny-sounding exercises. Mm-hmm. And then he waited 10 years or so and wrote the second version, which is sort of 1,000 times more difficult than the first version. And you know, sort of ridiculously dense writing. And in fact, for the third and final version, he reined it in a little. He decided his youthful excesses and his showing off that he could play with all 10 fingers at all times in 30-second notes. He decided that although it was kind of fun to do that, it wasn't necessarily musically the best result, and indeed doesn't even necessarily create the best virtuosic effect. I mean, I've heard a couple of these second version Transcendental Etudes, and it's just sort of bewildering. I mean, it's sort of this dense mass of sound that assaults the listener, and doesn't actually have the same effect as the third version, where he culled out about 25 or 30% of the notes, I suppose, and streamlined it and gave the etudes their descriptive titles for the first time, and created the masterpieces that they are. And it's really an interesting lesson in how, you know, these modest little exercises that he wrote when he was 16, that seemed so bland and uninspired. Just you clothe them right, and all of a sudden it's genius. Anyway, so this is the last one, Chasse-Neige, which is a sort of a snow flurry or a snow squall or something like that. And so it'll get us ready for winter.
As played by our guest and weather forecaster Christopher Taylor.
Of the Transcendental Etudes by Franz Liszt, the third version,
yes.
As played by Christopher Taylor, Chasse-Neige.
We'll be getting to the quiz question in a few minutes. We have some more Christopher Taylor to listen to, though, and mm-hmm. find out about. This is a composer whose name will not be familiar to many people at all, I venture to say.
Yes, Derek Bermel is a young up-and-coming composer. He was actually a student of Balcom's at the University of Michigan, and that's where I met him when my wife was getting her doctorate at Michigan. I bumped into Derek there, and it's been a fruitful collaboration for us ever since. He's a great composer, and certainly you hear Balcom's influence in it, but it's sort of updated for our generation, I guess. So this is actually a suite that he composed for me entitled Turning. So I premiered it in Paris in 1995, and I've played it at fairly regular intervals since then. So I thought we could do the last two movements, which run into each other. And there's a Carnaval Noir, which is kind of has a sort of Caribbean flavor to it. And then at the end of that one, it sort of somehow it goes a little wrong and it goes sour. It turns dark and it sort of blows up a little bit, and there's a big sort of crashing sonority, and then it segues into a coda, which is actually quite dark and quite a contrast with its predecessor, but which brings back ideas from earlier in the suite that we won't have heard, of course.
Sounds like he could have called it Tropical Depression.
Yeah, exactly. I think maybe I'll mention that as a possibility.
Here we go. Atmospheric.
Delightful music by Derek Bermel, part of his suite that was written for pianist Christopher Taylor, Turning. We heard Carnaval Noir and the coda.
Right.
Well, the next couple of concerts that you'll be playing in Wisconsin are going to be next Friday, the 15th. You're part of a tribute to Gunnar Johansson.
Correct.
And the celebrations that weekend. And on Saturday night, the 16th, you're playing, Beethoven, Schumann, Liszt, and a piece by Gunnar Johansson at the River Art Center in Sauk City.
Right, yes.
Prairie du Sac.
One or the other, right next to each other.
Yeah. So thank you very much for taking time to come in and bring some of your music with you.
My pleasure. It's nice to be here. Thanks.
Our guest has been Christopher Taylor.